Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judith Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. So in our never-ending list of wonderful guests that we've had on the show, we have today attorney Paul Samakow. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Paul is coming to us from Florida today, but Paul is a 40-year veteran attorney, a former legal call-in radio show host. I love call-in shows, by the way. A former syndicated legal columnist, the author of 6 books, and yes, I did go online to look at several of them, Paul, and we'll read them. Now the host of a for consumers legal podcast called The Legal Merry-Go-Round, which I enjoyed. I've listened to it. And a happily married man and proud grandfather of Noah, born in May of this year. Well, he was born in a pretty spectacular year, Paul.
She.
Oh, she. Thank you.
N-O-A, not N-O-A-H.
I was just going to say, because there's no H at the end.
There's no H.
Wonderful. So the reason why I'm very happy that you've decided to join us today is because people have an enormous fear of attorneys. And I want to dispel the fear. I want to get rid of it because one of the jobs I have in my own practice of getting people divorced, amicably divorced, and to mediate with them, I want them to get legal advice. And people think that it's a code of honor if they don't get legal advice and they do this all on their own. And I say, no, being educated is where it's at. So let's start, Paul, because you do some divorce law, or you have done some divorce law. We'll get to that in a minute. Why are people afraid of attorneys, and can we get rid of that fear?
I think the very first thing, Judy, is money. There's an inappropriate and most of the time inaccurate understanding or belief that the moment you pick up the phone with an attorney, the meter starts running and it's just ridiculously expensive. And I am not any longer a divorce law practitioner, but when I did it, I can understand, you know, the concern of individuals that were calling because they raised it right, you know, at the very beginning. Can I just talk to you for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and just tell you my story? And I'm thinking to myself, it's not going to take 2 or 3 minutes, but yeah, sure, go ahead. Many more experienced family law attorneys will charge a reduced rate for a first consultation. Attorneys only have their time to give and their intellect and their abilities and their skills in the negotiation of cases. But to bring on a new client, I think the divorce bar, the family lawyers bar of the United States is missing it. I think they should not be charging for that initial consultation, but they have to be clear at the beginning that, hey, I can give you 15 minutes, I can give you 30 minutes, whatever their comfort level with the attorney. But that's the first and biggest objection. And the reason I think that people are afraid of calling attorneys because they are not the richest people in the world. They don't have, you know, a lot of money and they're concerned. And I'll say this, and it might be a ridiculous thing to say in today's world of political correctness, but I think that's double for women who, you know, more often than not, you know, maybe a lot less than a decade or 2 decades ago, but they're not the breadwinners. They're at home taking care of the children in that traditional family, and they're very nervous about getting on the phone with an attorney who's charging $850 an hour. Now, I can keep going on, and I'll make this the Reader's Digest version. The second thing I think that, you know, people have with fear of attorneys, what is the joke? That attorneys are more disliked than used car salesmen. And the image of attorneys across the United States, I think, is one seen by the attorneys who practice in my niche area, which is personal injury. So you turn on the TV during the day parts and even weekends, and be it on, you know, cable or being on a network, and you see all these attorneys, and the expression is ambulance chasers. you know, oh, if you've been hurt, come to the law offices of blah, 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 and you get a free consultation, and, you know, we fight for you and we care for you. And I call those commercials terrible, and I call them me, me, me. Me, me, me. I'm great. I fight hard. I care. Okay, well, baloney. You know, of course, that's what everybody's saying. If you care, show people you care. Don't tell them you care. And that is not lost on the consumer who's watching these TV commercials over and over and over again and feeling that these attorneys are just below used car salesmen in integrity. Otherwise, how would they be able to get on and say these things, which is such foolishness? I care. I fight hard. Well, you better care and fight hard if you're my attorney. What are you telling me that for? What's in it for me, Mr. or Ms. Consumer is asking. So the profession of attorneys in the personal injury field, I think, has done damage to consumers of legal services all across the spectrum of all measure of legal services. Now, that's just one man's opinion, but I think that, you know, I don't think I'm entirely wrong.
No, Paul, explain something to me, please. It's my understanding that only certain attorneys are actually allowed to do advertising, paid advertising, on traditional mediums. Am I wrong, or can any attorney do it, but it's not really looked at favorably by the legal community?
There was a landmark Supreme Court decision called Bates versus Arizona, I believe it was 1963, that cemented the concept that attorneys are allowed to advertise. And this is a good thing for the consuming public because they should know what legal services are available and how to get them rather than scratching their heads and having all measure of bad things happen because they didn't know who to call or where to call or what to call for. And I do believe that if you're an attorney, you can advertise your legal services and what you do in any medium that you want. Of course, personal injury attorneys, car accident lawyers, advertise 150 times more than any other niche practice, divorce lawyers, criminal lawyers. But I see ads all over the country when I travel for all measure of attorneys offering up their services, divorce, bankruptcy, tax lawyers, criminal lawyers. So, you know, yes, I think every lawyer, you know, has the availability of advertising if he or she wants. Within a niche area of a specific geographic market, whether the other practitioners in that niche are going to frown upon somebody who does that, I couldn't say. I know that success does bring resentment. So if you've got a criminal lawyer and pick the city, pick the state, who's advertising the bejeebies out of, you know, the market, and nobody else is, everybody else is throwing darts at him or her because he's so successful because of his or her advertising. So that's a possibility.
Well, Paul, you have 7 offices between Maryland and Virginia. Do you still have 7 offices?
No, actually, because of the COVID pandemic, I've reduced it now down to 4.
Okay.
So they were satellite. The ones I stopped running were the satellite small offices with just one person working in them.
Okay, understandable. So Do you get your business by word of mouth, or do you do some consumer advertising?
Most of it is word of mouth. I've been an attorney for 40 years, so I've got a lot of people who I've helped, and they refer their friends and family and neighbors to me. And I do advertise. You know, I do a lot of media advertising in a lot of different formats. I do TV. I do a little bit of radio. I do have a person working for me who's doing some what I'll call social media posting, which is in one form or another an advertisement. My podcasts are, in a manner of speaking, marketing. You know, I used to do the radio show and the column. And so, you know, yeah, I like to put myself out there because that's, I think, valuable. I like to give information and give value rather than just, if you've been hurt in an accident, call the law offices of, you know. So, yeah, I mean, but I put myself out there as much as I can, you know, as the expression goes, you know, whatever is on my radar that I can figure out how to do and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg, I do it.
Paul, You no longer practice divorce law, but you did.
I did.
What can you tell people listening to this podcast would be some tips, helpful tips, in how to work with an attorney, regardless of whether you need full representation or just somebody to use in a as-need counseling position?
Well, Judy, you're familiar with the concept of collaborative divorce.
Right.
So I am a fan of that concept. But where a couple is moving apart and they cannot find an attorney to help them with that process, which, as you know, is one that is designed to try resolve issues without the expense and the duration of a litigation process with two different lawyers. Absent that, if there are going to be issues of things like alimony or child support or visitation and custody and division of assets, with anything else in any other area of law, a tip for someone in that position looking to, you know, move forward with the dissolution of their marriage: the better prepared you are, the easier it is for your attorney, and the smaller issues try and resolve yourself. And that is the second step. The first step in working with an attorney is a question I'm asked constantly by people: how do I find and choose the right attorney? And the answer is that you have to pick up the phone and get on the phone with them. You cannot look at a website. You can't look at an ad. It's a good idea to talk to your friends if they've gone through the same process and who can recommend somebody, but that still may not be a match. A relationship between an attorney and a client is a special relationship. It doesn't mean they're going to be best friends and inviting each other to each other's homes for supper or going out to drinks on a Saturday evening. But I believe that the relationship is an important relationship, and you need to have an understanding that you can pick up the phone and ask your attorney a question and the attorney will answer, but respect limits and boundaries so that every single time something happens, you're not whining and complaining to your lawyer. Because, you know, on some level, that is going to cost more. And, you know, again, I mean, I don't in any way demean people who have these issues, because often they're emotional and they're not logical, but they have to understand that they need to be able to get out of the emotional trauma that they're in or that they believe they're in, and use their head and their common sense to try and resolve. And in a dissolution of marriage circumstance, that means trying to resolve with the partner or the spouse. And it's hard because, you know, there may be many things that are going on. It may be a cheating situation where you have no more trust, or it may be, you know, any number of things. It may be that one of them is now involved in drugs and doesn't know what's going on and is constantly high or drunk and you can't communicate. You know, these are special situations, but to the extent for a potential client to help themselves with the lawyer, get a good feel for the lawyer, have that connection with that lawyer, let the lawyer set rules and boundaries as to the method by which and when communications can take place, and do as much work as you can. So when you sit down with your lawyer and your lawyer says, okay, well, you're getting divorced or you're separating, what is it that are your goals? If the client does, well, I don't know, that doesn't help the client. You know, I mean, don't make the lawyer cherry pick detail after detail after detail. Come in with an intelligent list of things that, you know, I have this much money, I earn this much money, I have these expenses, I need support in this amount of money at a minimum, I have my child that I have to take care of, I want to have, you know, hopefully the spouses have shared legal custody, even though one of them may have primary physical custody, so that, you know, both parents are involved in the raising and the rearing and the joy of having children.
So nicely, you know, said, by the way, nicely said on that point.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You know, I am a divorced man. We've talked before this podcast here, Judy. I've told you about that.
We're going to go into that in a minute.
And my divorce was not a happy one. But I will give 1,000,000% credit to my wife, my ex, and I imagine she'll say the same about me. We were able to keep the children as the first priority, and we were able to keep their well-being as the first priority. And I didn't badmouth her, and she didn't badmouth me in front of the children. And we were fair and we were reasonable about anything involving the kids. And that's the beginning and the end of the amicable part of it. But
and that's the most important part.
It is the most important thing.
It is. True. So you practiced divorce law prior to getting divorced, true?
I did.
And so did your experience on the legal end of it help you when you were a client, on the client end? I know it's emotional and it's very personal and it doesn't translate.
I met my first wife when she was graduating law school, and I was in my practice of law for about 5 years at that point. And I did lots of different things, including handling divorces and doing that sort of thing. And when I got married, and it was few and far between, and I just found the practice to be very upsetting, because no matter what I did, the clients were always upset, and they weren't blaming me necessarily, but I just didn't have the personality type to be the psychiatrist as well as the lawyer.
And we all fall into that position at whatever we do in family law. It is true.
It's true, and I admire those family law practitioners that can do both. But now that I'm a happily married man in the beginning years of my first marriage, and I'm doing divorce work, there was just an incongruency. I mean, I'm listening to people screaming and yelling and cursing at their spouses and what their spouses did, and I'm coming home and I'm supposed to have this wonderful relationship with my wife, and it just didn't work, so I gave it up. And then about 8 years later, our marriage started falling apart, and there was other things going on. And so I would say that my experience helped, as I was a client of my lawyer for my divorce, in one respect, and that was, again, the concept of children first. Children first.
Absolutely. And you know what's fascinating to me, and my heart goes out to every single couple divorcing with children. It's very difficult to be hurt, to be in a position of need and stressed out emotionally, and then be told, or at least think, you're putting your child first. I think we need to explain, any of us in the divorce business, what it actually means to put your child first. I think it's a nebulous concept. And I'll give one example, because it comes up constantly. Well, two examples, actually, in the co-parenting schedule. When you have the movement of a child 2 to 3 times during the week, back and forth to different parents' homes, how can that be healthy for a child? Number two, introducing new partners into your child's life. So you're going through a divorce, you just told your children you're getting divorced, and now there's this other person that has to be reconciled while the children are still trying to reconcile an enormous change in their life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And each age group, there are different understandings and concerns. I mean, it's very different when you tell a 4-year-old that I'm divorcing mommy than if you were to tell a 14-year-old I'm divorcing mommy. This podcast, this is not going to end after the new year, but I could take that long in talking about it out of personal experience and observations. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to balance what is the best thing for the children and make sure you're both committed to that. And it's hard.
Right. And sometimes putting the children first means you have to put yourself in a difficult position.
Right.
Using the new partner example, for instance, doesn't mean you can't have a relationship. It means you can't solely spend time with your children and that partner's there all the time. Your children need a separate relationship with you, their father or their mother, solidified, and then a new partner can be introduced. And that's even 100%. Tough for people.
Yeah, that's very hard.
Yeah.
I'll tip my hat to my current wife, who will be my last wife if she'll continue to put up with me. We met while I was actually still married and began a slow dating relationship. And one of the very first things that she said to me is, you know, I have two girls and I don't want you to feel like, you know, this is a problem, but you're not even going to meet them until one, you're divorced, and two, it's pretty clear that we have a future together. And I thought to myself, you know, good for you. I completely agree. So when I would go to pick her up for a date, I picked her up at a Burger King restaurant about a mile and a half from where she lived in a shopping center. And her children had no clue I even existed until a year and a half later. I was divorced, and my wife Susan and I, you know, our relationship got stronger and stronger, and turned out she was the one and I was the one. And at that point, you know, she slowly introduced me to her children, and I took her cue and did the same thing with my children for, you know, introducing them to her. So yeah, that's the introduction of a partner brings on all measure of potential problems. A new partner, I should say. Oh, that's not my mother. I don't have to listen to her, or, you know, and any number of things that, you know, that can come from it. So you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's absolutely golden to make that observation.
I interviewed a woman named Judy Graybill. She's in Arizona, and she's a step-parent coach. I had never heard of a step-parent coach before, but boy, did we learn a lot in that interview. And the first thing she said was, blended families are becoming more and more prevalent in our society. So let's set up some type of format to be able to successfully deal with it. And her suggestion was, all the adults need to meet each other first and be comfortable. So if you, Paul, you know, have a new partner, then that new partner would meet your ex-wife first, so that the kids don't have to worry about keeping a secret. The kids don't have to be put in the middle about choosing sides, because they're always going to be loyal to their biological parents, right?
Right.
And so you've given your children the best chance of a healthy blended family by giving them a foundation in which all the adults have come together.
I've never heard of that, and I can only stand up and applaud. I think that's tremendous.
Yeah, very nice. Going back to how you work with your divorce attorney the best, I have to say something. When I was looking at your biographical materials, I loved this paragraph. Paul says that his superpower is listening. I love that.
Thank you.
That is a superpower. Well, not only do we tell that to our clients, you know, you have to listen to one another. I'm a mediator. You need to listen until that person is done talking. But in terms of attorneys working with clients, Paul, wouldn't you say it's easy for an attorney to just go through the proper motions of being the attorney, doing the filing, and without really looking at their clients sometimes to see, are they going too fast? Or are they not letting their client explain their situation fully? Where is listening for you in your role as an attorney?
I want to share, Judy, that this is a muscle that, like anything else, has to be exercised, and it gets bigger and better and stronger. And I don't pretend that I have all the answers, but I do know from early on, I was taught and then made a concerted effort to understand the concept of listening. Listening means that I don't have an agenda. I'm truly listening to you. And I'm not waiting for you to finish so I can put in my two cents. I'm not over talking you. I'm not cutting you off. This is one of the biggest problems in relationships that people have. You know, well, let me finish what I was saying. And people just don't get it. You know, they have their own agenda in their head. But I want to tell you, you know, the spouse comes home and, you know, they both come home at the end of the day and they want to share what they did with each other, you know, during their day. Well, you can't understand what your spouse did when you're telling your spouse what you did. And so as an attorney, I find it's an obligation. I find it's almost malpractice. I'll go that far, not to give the client the full and complete attention to hearing their concerns and to understanding their goals and their objectives. And here's the hard part. The hard part is that, you know, like it or not, now I may sound elitist and that's just the way it is, but my ability of clarity of thought and communication is much better than most people I meet. Most professionals, I think, would say the same thing. And I get a lot of people who come in and they just yammer and meander and they just want to tell all the details. And, you know, and like take a simple auto accident case. The facts are, I was driving down the street, the light was green, and I went under the light and through the intersection. The other guy ran a red light and he hit me. Okay, that's all I need to know about what I call liability. But most people want to tell the story. Well, I got out of bed and there wasn't frosted flakes in the oven, in the cupboard. And the dog ate the homework. And I knew that I had to get to the babysitter by 3 o'clock because she was leaving at 3 o'clock. I mean, the story just goes on and on and on. It's like, okay, you know, Fred, excuse me, hold it. Let me just ask you some questions. And I've learned a method by which I can do that without upsetting them and still make sure I'm listening. And so I'll say something like, you know what, this phone call or this initial meeting is one designed to see if I can help you. And if I become your attorney, I want to hear all the details. You know, it's so important to listen to people. People just want to vent. They want to tell you their story. And you must let them, because you will learn. You'll learn things that you wouldn't have otherwise known if it's just black and white, cut and dried, get to the bottom line. But in those initial encounters, I have been able to share with people, I want to hear the whole story, but let me just ask you a couple of real quick questions. You were in an intersection, you had the green, he had the red, okay, great. Did you get hurt? Yeah, I went to the hospital, okay, great. Now let's get to your story. Now I know that I can help you. I don't have to wait 35 minutes to hear about the dog ate the homework and that the radio channel wasn't what you wanted. I don't need all of that. But I would never say that to a client. That would be so disrespectful. But the listening part of it, goodness, I mean, in our interpersonal relationships, and particularly then take it up a notch in our professional relationships, it's a critical process of learning. I mean, as a lawyer, if I go into a courtroom and I'm going to present my client's case to a jury, they want to hear some of the detail. They want to hear the emotional. They want to hear the personal. And I won't know that if I never listen to the client. You know, I want to know that my client who had his hand all mangled in 7 surgeries because of this car accident, the jury wants to know that as a result of that, he wasn't able to play the piano for 1.5 years. And he was the entertainer in his family of 37 people. Anytime there was a wedding or a holiday or an anniversary or a baby was born or a marriage, he was the one that entertained everybody in his big house. And not only that, he played he played in church. You know, he played the organ. That was part of his life, playing. And this was taken away from him. If I don't listen to that, I never get it. The jury never gets it, and he gets less money. That's just a silly example, but you must listen to people. Your agenda has to be listen first.
Okay, so for those listening and considering hiring an attorney, even though divorced, this fits perfectly well. Because I just took a phone call yesterday. A woman is coming in today, but the phone call came in yesterday. And I had to stop her in the middle of the story. I listened for a while, and I said, I'm going to just ask you some yes and no questions where there are yes and no answers, because I need to know if I'm licensed because I'm not an attorney. I'm a document assistant, a paralegal on steroids, and a mediator. I need to know if I am licensed to do what you need to have done. So let's start with just a bullet point. What do you want to file for? What do you want to accomplish? Child support, back child support, spousal support, and just bullet points. And I've had to learn over the years, because I do really like listening to people. It's fascinating. As one judge who chairs a monthly meeting that I'm in says, you can't make this stuff up. One of the interesting aspects of working in divorce is you can't make this up. So sit back and not really enjoy the ride at other people's expense, but at least you're learning about life.
Right.
But in that, you're right. We, the professionals, have to get good at getting the facts first. So clients, be prepared to give the facts first. And then the story will come. There will be that time that the story will flesh it out because, well, A, if you're a lawyer and you have to argue the case, you need to know every color that the case comes in and all those nuances that will affect how you position your case, correct?
You're right. Yes. I love that word, color. I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So listening is important. We say that in mediation all the time. If you can do the impossible, and this is why I considered it a superpower. I love that you use that word. If you can do the impossible and just be quiet and listen without, and nobody's ever said this before, Paul, the agenda. We know the story's going on in your head and you're chopping at the bit. You want to tell it. Okay. Are you done yet? Are you done? Can I talk?
Right.
You'll know when you can talk in a mediation because the other person will stop.
Right.
And then it's your turn to talk.
Right.
And the meter is open. We don't have to leave at any certain time. But that is so unbelievably hard to listen when you have your own agenda. That's on the client side. On the attorney side, or the professional side, it is hard to listen to the same story over and over, isn't it?
It is hard. It is hard.
The same story over and over with a slight bit of nuance.
Yeah, but you know, look, I mean, I became a lawyer. At some point you can say, wow, the greatest lawyer in the world. Nobody's ever going to say that about me. But the point is, if the door doesn't open or the phone doesn't ring, I could be the greatest lawyer in the world. Nobody would know about it. So when that phone does ring, when that door does open and a client walks through, that client gives me several different opportunities. One is to help them. The second is I could make money. The third is that that person can refer other people to me so I can help them and make more money. And the point of all of that is simply that, yes, I've heard this story pretty much exactly the same time, same thing over and over and over again with a little colors of difference. I love that word. But I owe it to them to listen to them. They're giving me an honor and an opportunity in three different ways. And if I don't get that, like, you know, I should have had a V8. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like the attorneys that don't get that, I think are they're not getting it.
And people land in my office because they didn't feel they were heard by their attorneys, or their attorneys didn't remember where they were at in the case, which I guess is an issue of being overwhelmed and maybe taking more cases than your office can handle, right?
Yeah, that's an entirely different discussion, which I call management.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's the, you know, that again, I could talk until after New Year's about that.
Yeah. And the client does have power and control and they don't know it, I think. Or do you agree or disagree in this attorney-client relationship?
The attorney is the pitcher and the client is the coach who throws the attorney the ball. It's up to the client to decide the ultimate goal. It's up to the attorney to accomplish the goal. So I tell clients all the time, you're the boss. you know, I recommend we accept X number of dollars to resolve this. And if we can't get it, I recommend we file a lawsuit and go to court. And the attorney, the client will say, well, I don't want to go to court. And I say, okay, well, my opinion and my experience is we should get X dollars. If we can't get it, then, you know, it's up to you whether we go to court, but that means you might end up with less money. I don't care. I just want this. I just want, and you know, so they're the boss. They do have power. They don't have power on the how things are accomplished, but they have power in determining what the goal is to accomplish.
And they can be most helpful by supplying you with it, supplying their attorneys with the information necessary in a timely manner and
exactly.
in a complete manner with no surprises in the litigation portion. Right?
Yes.
You have to be forthcoming. A lot of people right. aren't forthcoming, or they shade their story. We're going on the color metaphor. They shade their story in such a way that they have no complicity. And then all of a sudden, there's another attorney talking to their attorney, and there's aspects of the story that never came up under privilege. And that doesn't work well. Because everything will come up, right? Everything has to be divulged.
It does, yes.
Okay, so that's for the attorney-client relationship. Part of what I do in these podcasts, and you're kind of a triple threat here, and we've done one thing. We've talked to you as an attorney. Part two, I do a little sub-series called The Exit Interviews, and I talk to people who have been divorced so they can share their experience, the good, the bad, and what's going to be most helpful to the listeners. So you did say the part of your divorce that worked really well was the way you and your ex-wife put your child first and really moved that portion forward in a successful way. Yes?
I believe that's true. Yes. And you know, and I won't offer that it was 100% perfect 100% of the time. There were bumps, but the overall, I would give us an A.
Good. Okay. That's excellent to hear. So, if you could redo anything to make it better, what would you have done differently in the divorce process?
In the divorce process, well, we had a happy marriage for 7 years. And my wife cheated on me. And that, in my mind, was just the absolute bottom end, no coming back. I admire couples who have, you know, cheated on each other and are able to main, you know, to resurrect their relationship. But for me, all integrity is lost. So I don't know how that would have changed. I mean, you know, is it my fault that she cheated on me? I mean, you know, who, that's the eternal question. Was I not a good enough husband? Was I not there enough? Was I not meeting her needs? Was, I mean, and there's a million questions that will never be answered as to why. And I don't know that that could be undone. I mean, I don't know how we go back in years 2, 3, 4, and 5 leading up to the breakdown in year 7 so that she would not have cheated on me. I don't know. I mean, I, you know, spent some time on that, but it's just, it's an unanswerable question, and she will, you know, she will never own up to 100% of the reason. So, you know, that's an unknown.
Well, more so, there's hurt then. There was hurt in that that led to the breakup. So how did that hurt manifest itself in either the communication you two had during the divorce process or the settlement discussions? Did the hurt become the backdrop that made the divorce communication very difficult?
The communication was strained. Probably at the beginning, it was because of hurt and emotional feelings, daggers out of both of our eyes towards each other. Retrospect is, you know, perfect, you know, Monday morning quarterback type of conversation. Communications were strained. She turned out to be someone who was then only concerned about money and making crazy allegations and causing all measure of havoc in my life and my professional life as an attorney. with her attorney, who turned out to be someone who was a competitor of mine and delighted in trying to destroy me. Well, my attorney was an absolute gentleman and, you know, was always trying to just calm things down. But, you know, he was dealing with an attorney whose purpose wasn't necessarily just, you know, helping his client, my ex, but it was also in trying to destroy me. So it was very strained and very bitter. Eventually we worked everything out, you know, I mean, so we did end up, you know, not having a judge decide. I mean, we ended up with an agreement that was signed. But
how long was the process from the beginning of filing to the conclusion? How many years did it take?
A little less than 2 years.
Okay. Is that kind of an average? What state did you get divorced in?
Maryland.
Is that kind of an average? Or let me ask it this way. What is Maryland's minimum amount of time in which they will allow a divorce to be final?
My recollection is you have to be separate and apart for 180 days. And if it's an uncontested divorce, theoretically, I mean, you could go in right after that and file and the judge will stamp the papers and you're done. But that's not what happened in my case.
Okay. I also talk on this podcast about the emotional divorce versus the legal divorce. And we talk about going through all of the emotions, i.e. the 7 stages of divorce grief, and ending up with no more blame on the other person and even on yourself. If you are blaming yourself for the relationship, it seems that getting to that point, moving past it, allows you to be ready to engage in the legal divorce, because it's all about money and business and then the co-parenting schedule. Do you think that you both allowed yourself that time to emotionally heal before the filing started?
Unequivocally not. Not even close.
Okay.
Not even close. I mean, it was all a mishmash from day one. You know, I found out that she had cheated. It took me about a month and a half to get out of the house. I didn't even want to see her. So I went and found a place and I filed for the divorce. You know, I didn't want to wait to have her start telling me, oh, I'm sorry and let's try. And she never even said she was sorry. But let's, you know, I mean, so none of that happened. And I filed for divorce and I wanted to move it forward. And because of all the measure of different things that were going on, it just took a long time. But no, there was no healing. And now let's separate and get the paperwork done. None of that occurred in mine.
And then in the 2 years that all of the legal part of it started, were you a different person at the end of the 2 years? Do you think you went on that emotional roller coaster and landed just in a better emotional place to conclude?
Well, if you take day one when I found out, and then go for a month, month and a half, 2 months, you know, before I was actually out of the house. I was a strong, cocky, even conceited, high type A personality, the world at my feet, nothing I couldn't do or conquer. And emotionally, I came down several pegs because of many of the things that she said to me and, you know, the self-doubt about, well, why would she cheat on me? I'm a, you know, a great guy. I mean, our relationship intimately was wonderful. I mean, it just, you know, that really, really rocked me. So that's the first year. That's the first several months. And it took, you know, and I have no embarrassment whatsoever. I went right to a psychologist and sat on his chair. There was no couch. You know, that was about a 7-month process, which, you know, I think some men have a real issue with getting help, you know, from, you know, emotional counseling, what have you. And to me, that's just stupid. If you break your arm, you go to a doctor. Well, your heart is broken, go to a doctor. Your emotions are broken, go to a doctor. But I came through that better, and there was still issues of emotion. So by the time the whole thing was done, was I back to where I was before? Absolutely not. It took another year or so, and it took a great human being that I'm married to now to help me with it, because she also had a divorce, and hers was very different than mine. Her husband was just someone who just basically completely checked out mentally. And my current wife is an extraordinarily strong person and helped me tremendously, and gave me passes and gave me leeway when there were issues that some others might not have put up with. And that was during our dating relationship and early in our marriage. And by the time, you know, I was married to her for another, you know, 2 years, 5 years down the road, I mean, it couldn't be a stronger relationship. And now, to the extent that I'm back to where I was before all this happened, I mean, I think I'm there and I'm even better. But, you know, yeah, I mean, no, the day the divorce papers were signed, no, I was not back to where I wanted to be. And I knew that.
Thank you very much for sharing something so personal. I really appreciate it. And I want to go to part three, and that is, I talk to adults who generally have been children of divorce, just to share what that experience was like. But you have kind of a twist on that. When you were a kid, your parents didn't get divorced. Did you share that? Because, and here's the reason why, here's where I'm going. Parents have a difficult decision. Do they divorce? Do they not divorce? And a lot of times people say they don't want to divorce because of the kids. And this is where I would like you to pick up.
My parents were both old school European. They were both born here in the United States, but they both grew up in homes that were old school European. And there wasn't a chance in the world that either one of them is ever going to ask for a divorce. That was just not a possibility, based on culture, based on background, and based on religion. And interestingly enough, religion has nothing to do with it, but in their minds, it did, because the religion, I'm a Jewish person, I'm proud to be a Jewish person. I'm spiritually very involved in my religion. But there's nothing in the Jewish religion that says that you can't divorce. I mean, it's called a get. But, you know, my parents didn't understand that, because my parents were not educated people. My father had more education than my mother, and he was 1 year shy of getting a high school education. My mother had street smarts, but many of her operating day-to-day things that in her life that she used as her guidance came from her parents, who were even less educated than she was, and they were just wrong. And my parents had a terrible marriage that I was able to observe probably when I was about 10, 11, 12 years old. A sister 2 years junior from me, and that was it, just the four of us in the house. Yelling, screaming, doing everything he could do at times when he was upset with her, what we would call today emotional abuse. He never raised his hand to her. He always embedded in me, you never hit a woman. A woman can be beating the crap out of you. You run, you don't hit her back. And that, I grew up with that, not understanding that's something I took from my father that I think is good. But goodness gracious, men hitting women, I'd like to hit them myself. I'd like to hit the men. But my father was an abuser, emotionally, psychologically, and verbally to my mother. I mean, I learned words that no 10-year-old should ever hear. And my mother took it. Sometimes she cried. Sometimes she went in the room and slammed the door. She had her faults. She didn't deserve it. But she taunted him. You know, I mean, I don't believe they had an intimate relationship ever, you know, that I was aware of. I mean, but she would come out in sexy negligees and, you know, be what, you know, in the world that I've learned, she would be a tease to him. Mm-hmm. And that was wrong. They should have divorced, but they never did. I mean, they were both miserable living in the same house, having two separate lives, and when there would be guests or family around, oh, they were the wonderful couple. Oh, Mumu, I love you. Oh, you're such a good cook. Oh, you're such a good provider. You know.
Really?
Yeah, it was all show. Yeah.
Interesting. So you, looking back, would have preferred a divorce.
I think at 100%. And you know, and now, you know, at the ripe old age of 41, you know, I'm turning 65 next month. I can look back. I have perspective. Children are pretty resilient. They will get it eventually, even though if there is it my fault, mommy and daddy are getting divorced? With enough positive reinforcement and understanding, they'll get over that and they'll understand it's better. They will. I mean, it doesn't have to be a defining event for children that their parents are divorced, particularly in today's world where, what is the statistic, 40, 50% of couples divorce with children? You know, so.
Well, it's up to 50 for first marriages. It's 70 for third marriages. So, yeah.
Well, you know, but there's enough classmates whose parents are divorced also.
That's true.
So, you know, so it's not, it doesn't have to be a defining moment that sends a child down the rabbit hole or puts them into a, you know, a drug-induced state because their parents divorced. I mean, so, yeah, I would have much preferred that they gotten divorced and, you know, and then going back and forth between my parents. I mean, that's a world I can't even imagine what it would have been like because my father was also very competitive with me. I mean, he was, I'll never, ever, ever forget this. This is one of those indelible photo Kodak moments, whatever the expression is. But the first time, and he never let me win at anything, ever. And I applaud him for that. I mean, he just, you know, when you're good enough, you might beat me. You know, whether it was basketball, billiards. Well, he taught me how to play chess. And I eventually beat him. You would think that I ripped his heart out. The look on his face when I said, checkmate. His verbal was, you could see on his face. I mean, he wanted to say, congratulations. Great job, Paul. You've learned. He wasn't able to do that. And I could just see how upset he was. I mean, my father was a jerk. But I learned a lot from him in terms of what not to do. So, you know, but, you know, and so being with my dad was one of, I'm competing with this guy. And it's an unfair advantage. You know, he's older than me, more experienced, more knowledgeable, stronger. You know, he never hurt me. I mean, he taught me how to wrestle. He never hurt me. But, and then I go to my mother, and my mother is besieged with keeping up the appearances. And, you know, she had her, you know, her whole aura that I don't know that I ever really connected with her in a way that a child would want to connect with his mother. And, you know, there, I mean, and that's not 100% of the time. I mean, there were a lot of great things. I mean, my mom made me believe that I'm the best, the brightest, the smartest, the most handsome, the strongest, the fastest. She instilled that into me. No question about it.
Well, you totally took that to heart.
Well, I think at this point in my life and even before now today, I do have a bit of humility in me, I hope. I know that I'm not the best, the brightest, the strongest, or the fastest. But, you know, I think I do have a very good dollop of self-confidence. And that's because of my mom.
Nice to hear. And you do actually, I think, have a great balance of humility and confidence. And I love that. I love when people yes. have a lot of self-confidence, but they're also humble.
Well, hopefully that is me. I mean, you know, it's
Paul, I really appreciate the time you've taken with us today. Our time is up. We're almost at the end of an hour. And even though you're not in the divorce law business any longer, I still love the fact that you have this podcast, the behind the scenes of the legal world. And I'm thinking that it can translate to divorce if people listen to your podcast. Plus, people who are getting divorced do get in accidents too. So how do people reach you?
Well, thank you. I have a phone number, which once you hear it, you'll never forget it. It's the most easy phone number in the world to remember. It's 301-5-MILLION. 301-5 and six zeros. And that rings right through to my cell phone. And so I'll do an embarrassing but unapologetic pitch. The latest thing that I've been doing for the last couple of years is helping individuals who are burn injury survivors. Mm. So if you're not in the Washington, D.C. area, you're not going to be hiring me for a car accident. I'm licensed in Maryland and Virginia, but I have a national practice of helping individuals who have suffered burn injuries. And that is something that is turning into really a mission for me. I've written books. I'm writing a book now. I've written a few papers, and I'm trying to disseminate them. And what happens with burn injury survivors is that at the very beginning, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, if they're serious injuries, they're not concerned about legal and the potential for compensation. They're concerned and consumed with getting well. And they don't understand that even though they're in the midst of that getting well process, both physically and emotionally, that it's very, very necessary and appropriate to reach out to an attorney to get help, because there are things, just simple things, of preservation of evidence, that if we don't act and look at them now, they could be gone forever and could hurt the legal case. And burn survivors' claims, Judy, they could be millions and millions of dollars for the therapy they're going to need and the medical care they're going to need and the psychological counseling they may need if that's something that happens. You know, the younger you are as a burn survivor, the more likely it is that you're going to have very, very serious issues with self, with your self-image and confidence. You know, you go out in the public and people give you a look. I mean, that's hurtful. And so it's appropriate to have counseling. And there's just so many things that are involved. So, you know, while I'm not, you know, actively, you know, using your podcast to solicit for clients for burn injuries, you know, if they want to call me, if they have a friend or anybody that, you know, is in need or something, just wants information, I like to think of myself as a resource. So it's 301-5-MILLION.
No, I am so happy that you brought this up. First of all, because we just laid the framework down for the type of person and attorney you are. And this kind of hit home for me just now, because a year ago, I divorced a couple. I filed for them and I mediated. And he, when he was in high school in chemistry class, was the victim of a burn accident. Now, to your point of it psychologically affecting you, unfortunately, he is a drug addict. But all of the operations that were done were so good. He looks fabulous. If he had never said that, I would never have known. But it has emotionally scarred him. And his self-image is such that he wears those scars in his mental image of himself. He
right.
Doesn't even look in the mirror and see that he doesn't look any different than anybody else.
Right.
And I love the fact that you said if somebody for you even doesn't secure the help of an attorney, hopefully you could be destroying valuable evidence and not understanding how you have to look at everything going on in these beginning stages so that you can have a case that works.
Right. There's a lot of parts to the puzzle, but you know, the sooner an attorney gets started working on it and investigating it and preserving evidence and talking to witnesses and determining liability and getting experts involved to provide information and opinions, the stronger the case could be. And ultimately, it leads to money. You know, the more money that's available, hopefully the more money is you know, that money can be used for any number of things, including, you know, the medical care that might be needed and the psychological counseling that might be needed.
Absolutely. I'm so happy you brought it up, even at the end. So everybody, thank you so much for listening to Paul Samakal, who used to be a divorce attorney, but is a divorced man. was brought up with parents that possibly should have divorced. But now we just ended with a, he has a fabulous podcast I would love for you to listen to called The Legal Merry-Go-Round. And now we know that you have a specialty that you have passion for, and that is helping people that have been victims of serious burns. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
And
go ahead.
I was just going to say thank you.
yes, and you can reach him at 301-5-MILLION. Got that right, didn't I?
You did.
And you can join us again next week at Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. You can reach me, Judith Weigel, at my email address, judith@amicabledivorceexpert.com, judith@amicabledivorceexpert.com. I thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to speaking with you next week. Take care, everybody.